Hello and welcome to Soul Portals, exploring psycho-spiritual horizons with your hosts Cedric Spire and Deanna Nagel. Cedric is an author and therapist who developed the interview guidance model and is a pathfinder in the psycho-spiritual realm. Deanna created the Essential Soul Care Model, a model suitable for therapists, coaches, and healers. The monthly episodes of Soul Portals feature guests sharing insights from their personal paths and professional practices. Thank you for tuning in for the Soul Talk with all kinds of trailblazing teachers and guides as Cedric, Deanna, and guests explore new evolutionary landscapes.
So welcome again to Soul Portals, and I always say a brief opening generic invocation. It goes like this: may the spirit flow freely through this conversation, allowing it to be both energizing and edifying. And then in our general format, before we go with the flow, the opening quote actually comes from our guest's book, very entertaining and wise reflections on the road with Rabbi Stan Seltz. Well, that'll be in the resources. So this is a Q&A with the rabbi, the question being, what is the role of the Jewish scholar? And since our guest is a renowned, esteemed Jewish scholar, This applies to you, Arthur. In addition to his ability to memorize and understand texts, one of the most central drives for a Jewish scholar is to innovate. To use a possibly low metaphor, Confucian scholars wanted to have an old woman in an old dress, modern culture wants a young woman in modern dress, and Jewish culture prefers a young woman in old dress. Thus, although the Jewish scholar always claims that he's just creating a commentary, he is really constantly driven to create new things as new ideas. So that was Rabbi Stan. So he could have been talking about you, Arthur. So very briefly, because we're going to get into it in more depth, just to remind people of the theme that's related to Passover coming up in a few days. And we're looking at the inside story of Passover. So the personal transformation that corresponds to the collective and the cultural and the religious one. That's the portal we're looking through today. But then it expands as it will. So Deanna, over to you for a little continuation of the intro.
Yeah, so Arthur, we know you are a Jewish scholar, you're an author, you're a teacher and a publisher and a magician. I'm very curious about that. In brief, before Cedric takes us on a more personal journey, is there anything else you want the rest of us to know about your work, your vocation?
I don't think so. I think you pretty much covered it. Of all the things that you mentioned, the thing I love the most is the magic, by the way.
I bet.
I mentioned, I don't know if you have the resources, whether you do a few tricks. Are they still called tricks in the magic world? Because you bring a lot more to it than tricks.
Well, except for the people who claim that they have special powers.
Right.
They're called tricks.
Right. So do you have any at hand or any simple ones later on?
The kind of magic I do is not effective on right. The screen. It's really up close and personal. Or I do a show that's a large show as well, but nothing that I've been able to practice that works on the internet. Well, let me see. Yeah. I have something in my pocket.
Okay, because that would be one of the most original kickoffs of a podcast.
So we'll see if this works. I have two cards here. One is a nine of clubs, and one is a
Like, yeah, bringing
two of diamonds.
two of diamonds,
I have
yeah.
two of diamonds and the nine of clubs. So I'm
Okay.
going to take the nine of clubs away. What does that leave me with here?
The two of diamonds.
No, the two of diamonds is here. I can do that
Okay.
again. Here's the two of diamonds, and here's the nine of clubs. Take the nine of clubs away, and what does that leave me with here?
The
Two of
Anybody?
diamonds.
No, you're
Well, here's the two of diamonds over here.
the something of clubs.
So I don't know if that worked or not, but
It
that's a
did.
little magic trick.
While we're on the subject, can you tell us about how you tie that in to the wisdom and the Jewish tradition? Because it gets really interesting how you integrate the two.
Well, my show is based on one basic idea. The name of my show is Searching for God in a Magic Shop. And I perform it around, usually at synagogues. And the idea of the show, I do a bunch of really cool magic tricks, but the idea that runs through the show is that every magic trick works the same way. Whether it's a small magic trick that you can do one-on-one to somebody, or if you have big illusions on a Las Vegas stage, all the magic tricks work the same way. And how do they work? The audience doesn't see everything. If the audience were to see everything, they would know how it works. And that's the way of God's world. We don't see everything. There's so much that goes on, and we ask questions why and what we don't, but we don't see. How could somebody like me, a small dot in an infinitely vast universe, claim or even desire to know everything? It's impossible. So we have an expression in Aramaic in Jewish tradition called Gamzu Latova. And Gamzu Latova means everything is for the best. In some inexplicable way, everything is for the best. I have to, it's an assumption that God knows what he's doing. So in my show, I'm trying to express those ideas, particularly the idea that we don't see everything. If we were to see everything, we could come up with a good explanation. But we don't see everything. So, like a magic trick, it's something is hidden.
Right. There you have a story from Rabbi Akiva on that. Do you have that story memorized? Because I can read it later.
Well,
The one.
the famous story from Rabbi Akiva is that Rabbi Akiva was who was one of the maybe the superstar of the Talmud, or one of the great sages in Jewish tradition. He was looking for lodging, and the Talmud says that he had with him three things: a candle, a rooster, and a donkey. Is this the story that you're referring to?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So Rabbi Akiva was in a town, and it was evening, and he was looking for lodging. He knocked on the door of the inn and asked the innkeeper if he had a place for him. And the innkeeper said, "No, I don't have any place for you." And Rabbi Akiva responded by saying, "Gamzu Latova, this is for the best." He knocked on another door, and nobody was giving him lodging. And each time they refused him lodging, he said, "Gamzu Latova, this is for the best." Well, he realized that he would have to go out into the woods in the outskirts of town, and he made camp, and he was out there, and in the middle of the night, a wind came and blew out his candle. And he said, "Gamzu Latova, this is for the best." The text says that in the middle of the night, an animal came and killed his rooster. And Rabbi Akiva said, "Gamzu Latova, this is for the best." The text then says that his donkey in the middle of the night ran away. And Rabbi Akiva said, "Gamzu Latova, this is for the best." Well, the next morning he got up and he went back into the town that had refused him lodging, only to discover that in the middle of the night, a band of hooligans came and murdered people and destroyed property. And that's how the story ends. It's just a story, but the message of the story is that we don't see everything. That you would think that by being refused lodging, that this was a bad thing, but he said it was for the best. Had he been given lodging, he might have been one of the victims during the middle of the night. Had the other things happened in a negative way, he also had this idea that God knows what he's doing, and everything in some inexplicable way is for the best. So this was a story by about Rabbi Akiva that represents the kernel of that idea.
Right. Okay, let me contest the story a bit, like your daughter did with Rabbi Steinsaltz. Part of the Jewish tradition is wrestling with God, right? You don't just take his word for everything.
Right.
So, how is the victims that you mentioned, how is it all for the best with them?
Well, there's a corollary that one has to explain about this phrase, Gamzu l'tova.
Yeah.
The corollary is that you never say it to somebody else. You only say it to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah,
If
that makes sense.
you fall and hurt your knee, I don't look at you and say karma. You know, if you fall and hurt your knee, it's my obligation to try to help to relieve your suffering. If I fall and hurt my knee, I can do anything I want with that suffering, including saying Gamzu l'tova, that in some way this is for the best. So you would never say it to somebody else or
Right.
about somebody else's suffering. That
Right.
doesn't mean that doesn't solve the whole problem, because
But
the
in
bad, you
general,
know,
yeah. Sorry.
so it reminds me of a phrase I use often: rejection is God's protection. But that's from a personal, a
Of course.
personal standpoint, not as we're talking about saying that to all the people that are no longer at the inn.
Right.
Right. Look,
Yeah.
it's difficult. It's a difficult idea. It may even be an impossible idea. For me, it's often impossible, but I still maintain the faith that God knows what he's doing. This is
So
not my
the
universe.
right.
I'm not responsible for everything.
Because
And often it happens in life that, I mean, haven't we all, so many of us have had experiences where something terrible happens, but right around the corner from that was something glorious that you never would have encountered had you not had that terrible thing happen. It opens up a door to something else. So we don't know what's good or what's bad. So we have to make the assumption that God is the source of everything, and that in the end, everything will work out.
So the extreme example would be like suicide would be the extreme example, and how is that all for the best for the person who commits suicide? Like, so that's stretching it. I know that's stretching the theme of the story and something
You
we may
know,
know.
again, my responsibility to that person is to help the person, not to speak theology when they're suffering.
Right.
The last thing a person needs when they're suffering is some theology. Now, there's also another corollary to it, by the way, and that is, it says in one of the books of the Mishnah, which is a classic book of Jewish learning, of a couple of thousand years ago, that you should acquire for yourself a friend. You should invest in a friendship and get yourself a friend. It doesn't say get yourself lots of friends. It says you should acquire for yourself a friend. So who's the friend? The friend is the person who you deputize. And you say to that person, when I'm suffering, I don't want you to help me to relieve my suffering. I want you to remind me of the theology that I've been learning all my life. You, as my friend, I'm giving you permission to do that. Everybody else, try to help me relieve my suffering. But my friend, I want him to be the person who reminds me that in some way everything is
Right.
really for the best.
Yeah, to bring it back to therapy, that's like the sponsor in the AA movement and program. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Or an accountability buddy.
Yeah, accountability. Buddy, that's a good expression. Yeah. And also since in your favorite book by Rabbi Steinsaltz, he does introduce reincarnation. So to answer my own question with somebody with a suicide that follows through on it, that would be the end of what their work in this lifetime to be like, and there would be a to be continued according to the perspective of faith.
Right, and the things that we experience in this lifetime are not necessarily born in this lifetime. They may have come as the result of something from a previous incarnation.
Right. Which, yeah, people are a little bit surprised that that's part of Jewish theology, but yeah,
It
that's
is. It's in almost all of the classic books on Jewish belief that
right.
it's called Gilgul HaNefesh, the reincarnation of the soul.
Okay.
But if you, everybody has an, this, the notion is that everyone has an assignment in this life. You have something that you have to repair in this world. And if you don't do it, when you die, you'll come back in the body of another person and you'll have another chance to do that reparation that was only yours to do. And you come back as many times as you need to get that work done.
Right. It's which is parallel to Hinduism. Yeah.
Yes,
And by the
absolutely.
way, that story with Rabbi Akiva is, it's like the same theme as the one that Alan Watts, that floats around, the one of good news, bad news, with the son going off to war. And you're probably familiar, Ram Dass used to tell that story. So
Yes,
same
absolutely.
exact theme, whether it's good news, bad news, and you keep finding out how it alternates.
That's right.
What you
There,
think is bad news is good. What you think is good is bad. Yeah.
exactly. And
Okay.
all of this is very, very common and popular in New Age thought. Different words, different language, soul's purpose, karma, but
Yeah.
many of the same principles.
Right. Yeah, because part of our mission and the interview approach is to bring back what was part of psychology in the beginning, which is the soul work. And it lost touch with soul work, became very clinical, tried to be a science, and we're part of bringing the soul work back. So my opening question, that was a good riff. My opening question is perfect for you because it's who or what most influenced the person you are today. Yeah, that's a slam dunk.
Yeah, that's a slam dunk. That's right. It's Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, who died a few years ago at the age of 82. But I had the great fortune, as some of you know, to be his chauffeur. I was his driver. Whenever he lived in Jerusalem, but whenever he came to New York, I was given the privilege of picking him up at the airport and driving him to all of his appointments and lectures and so forth. And I wrote a book about it called On the Road with Rabbi Steinsaltz, where I tried to retell some of the great things that I experienced and that I heard from him. He has an he had an interesting biography himself. He grew up in a family that did not offer him a Jewish education, so he knows the pitfalls and the difficulties of going from a secular person to going to being a religious person. And I had the same experience. I grew up in a household that did not offer me a religious education of any sort. And it was only after I left my parents' home and actually started doing a little genealogical research that I discovered that I fell in love with Judaism, and it transformed me. So Rabbi Steinsaltz fits that bill.
Right. What's interesting about Judaism, while it applies to all religions, it looks very different, or can look very different from the outside, looking into the experience on the inside, looking out. Because I'm half Jewish, by the way, in case you were wondering. My father was a came from an Orthodox family, married a shiksa, and I'm the result. So, yeah. But I have a lot of Jewish community, and when I delved into Judaism, the word that describes it for me is beautiful. It's a really beautiful religion on the inside.
On the inside, that's right.
Yeah. So was there a watershed moment when you realized the true nature of your vocation, when a turning point, a shift for you in your journey?
Well, I seem to have discovered over the decades that I'm a teacher, that I like to share knowledge. I'm told from any number of people that I'm pretty good at it. I know how to speak to particularly people who have no background, and everything that I've done seems to lead me in that direction of being a teacher. Even again, even my magic interest in magic tricks wasn't enough for it to be magic tricks. It was magic tricks so that I could teach something. So it seems to me that that's been my mission in this life.
And what principle, truth, or teaching guides your own journey? Like, what have you downloaded, so to speak?
Can you ask that in a different way? I'm not sure I know
Deanna,
what you're
Deanna, you're the one who translates for me.
talking about. Downloaded is similar to, what's been channeled. What's the great message from above?
Or from the tradition coming through you, that you're like the lens of teaching coming through you.
Well, I think, I think that we've just spoke about it before. I
Yeah.
think the it's tough talking about suffering. It's tough talking about the theology of suffering. But somehow or other, I am comfortable talking about it. Very few people seem to be comfortable talking about it. But it seems to be the question, why did God make a world with so much suffering? So the teachings on that question from Judaism are the teachings that have nourished me over the years. And then part of it is that journey of the soul, that your soul is my soul. Well, let me put it this way. Some people believe that you're just a body, that you're born, you live, you die. Some people believe that you're a body that has a soul. Jewish tradition doesn't teach either of those two things. We don't teach that we're just a body, and we don't teach that we're a body that has a soul. We teach that we're a soul that has a body. That soul existed before this particular body. The soul picks up this body and works with it for 60, 70, 80 years, whatever. Then the soul drops the body and continues on with its work. So the idea that we're not just a body, but we're a body with a soul, or a soul with a body, informs much of what I think about and do.
So you truly embody soul work
Is that
because you truly embody soul work
work?
because you are soul.
Nicely put. Thank you. Well put.
Yes, so that brings up the crossover that a lot of our audience would be interested in, are interested in, between therapy, be the spirituality that we're delving into here, and therapy, counseling, coaching on a psychological level. So, what do you have any experience in the therapy land, in that realm, and the way the intersection of the two?
When I first read something by Rabbi Steinsaltz in the late 70s, I read this essay by him and it blew me away. And I wrote him, I wanted to meet him. I wrote him a letter. And in the letter, I said that I read your book, I read some of your stuff, and I, if you ever have the opportunity, I would love to meet you. Well, he never answered that letter. But one day, about a year later, a woman calls me up and says, "Rabbi Steinsaltz is going to be in New York next week. How's Wednesday at 10?" And I said, "Wednesday at 10 is just fine." And from that moment until Wednesday at 10, when I got to meet the rabbi, I sat down to write, to think of the biggest questions in my life. If this guy is who they say he is, if he's this extraordinary spiritual genius that everyone seems to say he is, that when I see him, I'm going to go for broke. I'm going to ask him the biggest questions that I can ask him. And I came up with 11 questions. I got to see him that Wednesday at 10 and got to 9 out of the 11 questions. Now, I did pretty well that first time. He spent 3 hours with me. And that, so all, over the years, over the decades, I used to bring my problems to him. Now he was not, he was very directive. In other words, I was looking for advice. I wasn't looking for him to help me with my inner process of thinking things through and discovering who I am and so forth. So that's the closest that I would come to visiting a therapist, is visiting this spiritual man who seemed to have some wisdom to share.
Yeah, in Eastern terms, he'd be your guru.
In Eastern terms, he would be my guru. That's right. By the way,
Yeah.
Rabbi Seinfeld wrote once that Judaism is not a Western religion, that really Judaism is an Eastern religion. And when you mentioned Hinduism before and the parallel with reincarnation, that's just one of many pieces of evidence that indicate that it's not a Western religion, it's more of an Eastern religion.
Are those 11 questions copyrighted, or can we use them in a blog?
They're mostly personal questions. I'll tell you one question that I asked him though that I found pretty interesting. I asked him what he thought about marijuana. Now this was back when marijuana, here, I don't know about where you guys are, but here marijuana is legal.
Yeah.
But this was in 1979 when marijuana was prison term for you. So I asked him, what does he think about marijuana? And he said, well, first of all, I never tried it, so I can't speak about it from personal experience. But he said, the issue with marijuana is the same as the issue with anything in life, and that is, who is the master and who is the slave? He said, if you're a slave to marijuana, I would say it's not good. But he said, you could be a slave to coffee. He said, you could be a slave to Torah study. So to have an Orthodox rabbi saying that I can be a slave to Torah study is a pretty cool thing, I think. So if you're the master, not the slave, then you're going in the right direction. So that was the response he gave me about my asking about marijuana. And I found that many people who I've shared that with see the wisdom in it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean,
That
that speaks to moderation. It also speaks to, at least here in the United States, how we determine addictive behavior. Is it affecting your daily skills? Is it affecting your ability to maintain relationships, your vocation, et cetera? If
yeah.
it is, it's a problem. If it doesn't, then it's not.
Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about the chocolate. Was he the master or slave to the chocolate? Because because Rabbi Sonsalt loved chocolate and could say he was addicted to it.
Yeah, well, he also admitted that he was addicted to it.
Okay.
He said his whole family was, his children, his wife, his household were all chocolate addicts.
Well, good. So then he had the experience of the slave position, and
Yes,
to
yeah.
know both of them.
Yeah, he never represented himself as a perfect being.
Right. Yeah. Do you know that book? Remember the subject, The Pilgrimage of Psychotherapy Patients. The title was "When You Meet the Buddha on the Road, Kill Him."
Kill him. Yes, I remember that book.
Yeah. And exploring like the, it was probably one of the first psycho-spiritual perspectives on therapy,
Yeah.
and the mythology, the archetypes involved. Basically, the therapist as guru, right? Because there really is a crossover, which is why I was asking, about how psychology influences spirituality and vice versa. Right. So, I
But
mean, yeah.
there is this movement I'm seeing among therapists to make that process more collaborative with clients. So there's that, but the old school is that the therapist is the guru.
Right. Yeah, because it's a modern phenomenon, right? Because in the past you went to the priest or the rabbi or the imam, right? And
Or the shaman.
that basically was your experience, right? With any personal issues, you just put them in that, it got that wider view, that bigger perspective, and that was enough for you.
Yeah. I once said to Rabbi Steinsaltz, Rabbi Steinsaltz, I see that you often criticize people, but I've known you for over 30 years and you never criticized me once. Do me a favor and give me some criticism. He said to me, you want some criticism? I'll give you some criticism. He said, you're too nice a guy. He said, you're a nice pearl. I'd like you to be a diamond. The pearl is very nice, but it's smooth. The diamond has an edge. He said, "You're too nice a guy." So that's been
Right.
my koan for the for, since he told it to me. Trying to meditate on what that really means in terms of my own personal life.
Do you have
Well,
a yeah, sorry, go ahead.
we have a term in the coaching field and called, edgy. Edgy coaches are directive, not necessarily authoritarian, but directive. So
Yeah.
he's maybe just telling you to be a little edgy.
Yeah, I thought I was a little edgy, but I not edgy enough for him.
Right. Do you have any funny stories about his edginess? You said in the book you were talking about how he did it a lot with audiences.
Well, one thing that comes to mind immediately is that I took him to a lecture one Saturday night. The Sabbath was over, and the people in the community gathered for celebration. And Rabbi Seinfeld walked into the room with a bottle of liquor under his arm and a stack of cups. And he proceeded to give people in the audience empty cups, and he poured the liquor into the different cups for everybody to take a drink. And then he proceeded to give a lecture for an hour or so on the benefits of getting drunk. He said, not unruly drunk, but just to get a little bit unstable. That a little bit of instability is what helps you to learn and helps you to move. He gave the example of an airplane. When is an airplane the most stable? When it's 30,000 feet in the air. When it's most unstable is when it takes off and when it lands. But you have to go through that instability in order to get to that stable place, 30,000 feet into the air, so, in the air. So he proceeded again to give this lecture to these people about the benefits of getting a little bit tipsy.
Right. So yeah, he's form of therapy with the audience.
Yeah, they surely did not expect such an answer from an Orthodox rabbi, but he gave that message, and it rings true for me.
Right. It's a again, Alan Watts, the wisdom of insecurity.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
right.
Yeah, your other passion is genealogy. So, how did you, that was a big influence on you and guiding your path, your journey.
It certainly was. One of the things I discovered through the genealogical research is that my great 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 grandfather was a Rebbe, was a guru type. He was a Rebbe, and it's the last thing I would have thought from my mother's family, who were all assimilated Jews, but a couple of generations back they were religious people. And it's that got me to wonder, what does that mean to be religious? What not just their names and dates on a family tree, but what were their lives like? How did they live? And the more I learned, the more I fell in love with it. So genealogy was very very important to me. It still is. I wrote two books on the subject.
Right. Okay, we better get to our theme, our main theme, which is Passover and
Okay.
the transition on a individual, like the meaning of Passover, like it said in the intro, as you know, going through the narrow places in our lives and coming to the promised land, which is a symbol of our transformation. And I've always positioned it like as going from ego to soul, like ego-centered to soul-centered. So I'd like your perspective on the meaning of Passover in 10 minutes or less.
Well, Passover is such a rich holiday with so many themes running through it. But I would agree with you and would reiterate that the question of ego is a big question in the pa Passover. Everybody knows matzah on Passover. So matzah does not have any leaven ingredient to make it rise. Bread and rolls and cakes that are leavened are all burned the day before Passover. So this leaven is a leavening agent is a symbol of boasting your building yourself up in a big ego way. And then the reason why we have matzah and don't have anything that's leaven is because we want to work on ourselves and work on our ego questions. Just this morning I was studying. I wrote it down. I was studying Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, which is one of the classic Jewish texts also. And the Mishnah number 13 in that holy sacred book says that one who advances his name will be forgotten. So, if you're somebody who's looking for fame and looking for headlines or looking for exposure in the newspaper and all that, the person who's looking for that person is going to be forgotten. That the task is not to boast yourself, build yourself up. Of
Right.
course, somebody once said that the biggest ego trip is worrying if you're on one, which I think makes some sense. But the counterbalance to the ego issue in Passover is that the Passover Haggadah, the book that we read at the dinner table, is filled with blessings of gratitude. I'm not the first one to say that cultivating gratitude is a giant step in one's spiritual work.
Agree.
Yeah, the clinical term is ego, narcissistic inflation for the problem of the ego. Anything else about the symbolism? I know it could, be a whole workshop, but anything that's really meaningful in the Passover
Sure, I
symbolism.
can, but. Well, just to build on the gratitude question for just a moment, we were slaves in Egypt, and God got us out. That's something to be grateful for. We wandered in the desert for 40 years, and every morning there was manna from heaven to feed us. Well, what feeds us is something to be grateful for. The festive meal that we eat on Passover. At the end of the festive meal, we have something called Birkat HaMazon, which is the blessings on the on of gratitude for the food that we eat. The Jewish tradition says that we should say 100 blessings a day. Now, 100 blessings a day actually is not so difficult if you participate in the three prayer services of Judaism, the morning, the afternoon, and the evening. Prayer services because they're filled with blessings. The morning praying, it's got loads and loads of blessings of gratitude, of thanks for all kinds of things. So the rabbis in the Talmud said we should say 100 blessings a day. Wouldn't it be wonderful if each of us could pepper our days with 100 moments of gratitude? So
Well,
then
and there's actually hard research that says, being aware of and documenting your gratitudes every day is good for positive mental health. So this ancient wisdom is seeping into the world of psychology. It's been a slow grow, though. Very
So
slow.
gratitude, especially in the midst of suffering. That Arthur, do you know the Holocaust story when they put God on trial in the inmates of the concentration camps?
Found him guilty.
They found them guilty, and
And then
then
he's,
what
and then
happened?
it's time to pray.
And now God is guilty. He broke the covenant, but let's go and say our evening prayers. Yeah, that in a concentration camp. So, yeah.
Judaism is very much about paradox also, which is partly what we're talking about. There's a There's a notion in Jewish thought that you should study for its own sake. Don't study for a ulterior motive. Don't study to become famous. Don't study to become a big shot. Why do we study? We study because that's what we're supposed to do. And the Hebrew expression is Torah lishma, Torah for its own sake. When I first came across that idea that we're supposed to study for its own sake, not for some reward, I thought, gee, that reminds me of some of the Eastern stuff I dabbled in college. Don't be attached to the labor, just to the fruits of the labor, just do the labor. So I was very intrigued by this notion of Torah lishma, to study Torah for its own sake, not for an ulterior motive. So one day I was going on a bus in Manhattan, going cross town, and I go onto the bus, and I see a man who's very well known in the neighborhood as a Talmud scholar. So I went over to sit next to him, and I introduced myself to him, and I said to him, I've been very interested in this idea called Torah lishma, that you should study Torah for its own sake. Don't study Torah for an ulterior motive, but study Torah because that's what we do. We study Torah. I said to this man, so I was interested in the idea, so I did some research on it. And I found that it says in this in the holy books that if you study for its own sake, you'll be rewarded. If you study for an ulterior motive, you'll be punished. So I said to the scholar on the bus, if it tells me that I'm going to be rewarded for studying for its own sake, then I'm not studying for its own sake. I'm studying it for the reward that they're going to give me for studying for its own sake. I said to the guy, this scholar on the bus, what does that mean? He looked at me, he said to me, Arthur, it's obvious that you're beginning to understand the Talmud. He goes, unless you see the paradox, you're probably missing the point.
Right. That's why you're a Dylan fan too.
I
Because
suppose so, yeah.
Mr. Zimmerman inherits that. Do you know the third Seder? Speaking of Passover, you know the third Seder for Yom HaShoah?
No,
And
I'm not
that's,
familiar with it.
this was a Haggadah created for the third Seder, on a different date for the
Holocaust Memorial.
Someone I saw in the comments, because we should transition to Q&A, so people can get questions in. And I saw someone ask about that story from the camp that we mentioned, the Holocaust story. They wanted to hear, I think we touched on it too briefly, knowing the story, and someone wanted to hear what that actual story was.
It actually, if I'm not mistaken, it comes from Elie Wiesel's book *Night*, which was his Holocaust memoir, where they one evening in one of the concentration camps, one of the death camps, they put God on trial, and after a lot of rumination, they decided that God was guilty. So they finished the trial. They declared God guilty. And they said, gentlemen, it's time to pray. So therein lies the paradox again. The very God who we found guilty is the very God who we pray to.
Right. And just the fact of putting God on trial and having a prosecutor in the defense, which they went through, right?
Yeah,
That
yeah.
that's very Jewish too. It says a lot about the relationship between man and God. That
Started with Abraham, who bargains with God, and it's a rich old Jewish tradition to argue with God.
Right. So John, are there questions from the chat, or you can open it up for, we have about 10 minutes left for Q&A.
We don't have any questions at the moment, but I guess there's that invitation. If anybody wants to pop something in the chat, be very welcome to. And yeah.
There is one that says we touched on this before, but wanting to know some more of the questions that you asked besides the marijuana question.
Unfortunately, they were very personal questions.
Okay, that's fair.
So So I apologize. I wish I had the courage to admit what my questions were at that time, but they were deeply personal questions that nonetheless I got some good answers to.
In our business, it's not courage. We call that good boundaries.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that very much.
Oh, there's a
All
good,
right.
great question. John, who reads the questions? Is
I can read.
it
What is it? What is it that made you fall in love in Judaism?
us? With Judaism, yeah.
One of the things that Rabbi Steinsaltz talks about, apropos of the question, in one of his books, is that when you grow up not religious and you become religious, it's not an aha experience. It's not a eureka, I found it experience. Rabbi Steinsaltz calls it a series of small turnings, a series of small turnings. So there was what wasn't anything in particular that made me fall in love with Judaism, but slowly but surely I started realizing that, I was a religious Jew. It didn't happen overnight. I didn't even realize it was happening. But apropos of your mentioning Bob Dylan, there was a I used to say there's a time in my life when if you were to mention an idea, I could match it with a Bob Dylan quote. And
That's
today,
what we do, yeah.
and today I'm much more comfortable matching an idea with a Talmudic quote. I just immersed myself in that world and that way of thinking, and more sooner or later I became it, and it became me. So we it's very, very rare in the Jewish world for someone to have a kind of born again experience. It's much more a slow process of integrating into who you are some of the ideas that Jewish tradition offers.
Right. Even in the born again experience, that's like falling in love, and you still have a marriage to go through.
Yeah,
You
yeah.
can't just ride the born again spirits all the way. Any other comments or questions popping up? So there's one, Tom. There you go.
I'm curious about the path from ego to interior freedom from the Passover story. How does one do that journey?
I don't think that's a question for me. I think that's a question for one of you. How do you work on yourself?
Well, the ego is full of a lot of shadow. So working on the shadow brings you into this place of non-ego or soul. So it's recognizing the work that needs to be done prior to the Passover, prior to the event, prior to the celebration. I was raised in the Christian faith, so there are some similarities there about realizing the death of Christ, the sadness, the understanding the sadness to get to the joy. It is psychological, but as Cedric and I talk frequently about, it's that psycho-spiritual piece. It's like it's something other than us that drives somebody into their soul work. It's whereas ego is very individualized, individual bound.
Isn't it a question of balance also? We have an ego. The ego is very useful. We exist and we get things done. It's who we are. But on the other hand, if it's inflated, it's out of bounds, then it's not healthy. Anything that's out of bounds is not healthy. So in Jewish tradition, we're always looking for for balance. Now, sometimes a radical thing is the most reasonable thing. So it isn't like it's some kind of an artificial middle for balance. But sooner or later, with the ego, you have to, the Passover experience tells you you have an ego, but don't become like Pharaoh in Egypt who thought he was God. That's a big theme in the Passover Seder too, that the Pharaoh of Egypt, he thought he was God. There's a very funny, I think it's funny anyway, detail in the story of Passover, that the Pharaoh in Egypt, he every morning he would go into the woods by himself. That's what the text says. It doesn't say why, but it just says that. But the commentary says it's because he had to go to the bathroom, because there were no bathrooms in the palace, because after all, the Pharaoh was God. God doesn't have to go to the bathroom. So Pharaoh snuck out every morning to do his business, but to make sure that nobody saw that he was actually mortal like everybody else.
Yeah, so the balance is important. We have a model with the actual map, like I call the compass points of personhood, and spirit, soul, ego, psyche, and in the center is the crossroads, and that's the point of balance. And wherever you're out of balance on either of those four points, the work is to bring it back to the center.
We have the same thing in Kabbalah. You
Yeah.
have There's an outgoing chesed, loving kindness, and then there's a gevurah, which is strength, and which is contraction.
Yeah.
It's the big question of that the parents have, right? How much do you say yes, and how much do you say no? If you're always saying yes to that child, it's a terrible thing. If you're always saying no to that child, it's a terrible thing. But somewhere in the middle, that some balance.
Yeah.
Again, between outgoing and
Protecting them.
tightness is what we're trying to aim for.
Yeah, and
Well,
to speak to the question briefly about how does the individual journey, replicate the Passover journey? It's going from identifying with your suffering and like building identity around being a victim. It's that we see in some patients, and then taking responsibility for your life and moving forward with that. So that's the parallel of the journey out of Egypt to the promised land being the individuation and taking the responsibility. When you grow up and you stop blaming your parents for who you are, right? So that's the just to speak to that great question. Sorry, Deanna.
I'm just gonna pull a little new age thinking in here, because we in some circles we talk in terms of 3D, 4D, 5D. So 3D means that, feet on the ground, we live in the earth. It's a real world problem, so to speak. My coffee pot broke this morning. 4D is stepping into soul, but staying in ego as well. So that you have intention and you're mindful, and 5D is ascension. And so I often say to people who say they live in 5D that I personally think 5D doesn't happen until we literally ascend from this body. So 4D is sort of the balance in New Age speak.
Apropos of what you're saying, there's a well-known expression in Jewish tradition, a descent for the sake of ascension. Descent for the sake of ascension. That every descent is really, if you go to an amusement park and you see that roller coaster, the only way the roller coaster is going to get up to the top is if it comes down first and then picks up speed and is able to then ascend. So it's a descent for the sake of ascension. So in a sense, Jewish tradition, we don't recognize the direction of down, because every down is really a prelude to the next up that you're gonna find. So every descent is for the sake of ascension.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so we're at 12:59. The last thing you can mention is the titles of your best-selling dummies book if people want to know more about Jewish tradition and mystical Judaism. It's those two titles, well, they'll be in the resources
The
also.
two dummy books that I wrote were Torah for Dummies and Kabbalah for Dummies. And it was a great experience writing both of those books. When you sign a contract with the publisher of the Dummies books, they send you a 40-page book called How to Write a Dummies Book for Dummies. And you have to follow that pretty closely.
Is it pretty easy? Like, can you do like paint by numbers?
Well, it's, you know, they it's not easy because what you they have you write your first chapter and you send in the first chapter. They're editing the first chapter and you're starting your second chapter. When you send in your second chapter, they send back the first chapter, asking you to answer all the queries that the editor made. Then you send in your third chapter and you're working on the second one also. And you have 1 week to do each chapter, a chapter a week. And each dummy's book is 22 chapters. So you have 22 weeks to write this whole book. But by the way they work it, by the time the 22 weeks is over, they're ready to publish. They're ready to publish. So it's a grueling, grueling. When I wrote Torah for Dummies, I swore I would never write another dummies book. But they came to me with the Kabbalah for Dummies idea, and I said yes to it. I don't regret it, but the reason I said no originally to myself is because it was a grueling process.
Wow, we've come a
So
long way.
I
Sorry.
just want to say something about this book, because I've almost finished it, but I want the people listening to know that when you read it, at least for me, it's very much as you have been today with us. It's very, very conversational. It's like, you know, I can, now that I'm going to finish the book, I will hear your voice. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.